Chapter 9. Surveying Buddhism. The adage that one thing leads to another may be seen as a homelier version of the basic Buddhist principle of praticca samuppada, or conditioned co-production. The principle that phenomena come into existence not by chance as a result of a decree of fate, but in dependence on a certain complex of causes and conditions. It was an adage that was certainly exemplified in the case of the circumstances that led to my being in Bangalore in the summer of 1954, and there delivering, under the auspices of the Indian Institute of Culture, the lectures which subsequently appeared in book form as A Survey of Buddhism. The Caitanya of these circumstances stretched back to the early months of 1947, when I was staying at the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture in Calcutta, and happened to come across a dusty pile of back numbers of The Aryan Path, a monthly magazine published from Bombay, containing as it did articles on both Eastern and Western religion and culture. I found the magazine of great interest, and spent many a happy hour working my way through the pile. During my wandering days, I read it whenever I had a chance to light upon a copy, whether at an ashram or in someone's home. And after my arrival in Kalimpong, not only arranged to receive it in exchange for stepping stones, but started contributing articles, poems, and book reviews. These contributions led to an exchange of letters with the editor, Sophia Wadia, who turned out to be connected with the Ananda Vihara, Bombay, and to have helped with the production of Dr. N. K. Bhagwat's edition and English translation of the Dhammapada, a copy of which I had bought in Delhi within weeks of my arrival in India and had carried around with me ever since. Sophia Wadia was in fact a theosophist and sympathetic to Buddhism, as was her husband, B. P. Wadia, who wrote in The Aryan Path under the Buddhistic pseudonym of Shravaka. They were not, however, Adyar theosophists. They belonged to a branch of the theosophical movement that repudiated as aberrations the Hinduizing and Christianizing tendencies of Annie Besant and C. W. Leadbeater, and sought to return to the original theosophy of Madame Blavatsky, which they believed to be closer to Buddhism. Such being the case, it was not surprising that they should be anxious to see a knowledge of Buddhism flourishing in India, and not surprising that they should want to have a series of lectures on Buddhism at the institute they had established in Bangalore. This was where I came in. At the beginning of the year, Sophia Wadia had sounded me out as to the possibility of my paying a visit to the Garden City. I had responded positively. Further letters had been exchanged, and eventually B.P. Wadia had formally invited me to give 4 lectures at the Institute during the first half of July. The last 2 days of June, therefore, saw me travelling down the east coast of the subcontinent in the Calcutta-Madras mail. Saranatha came with me to Howrah Station and saw me off, as did the scholarly Sadatisa, who was studying for his B.A. at the Benares Hindu University, and who, 4 years earlier, had been present at my bhikkhu ordination in Sarnath. I had spent little more than a week in Calcutta, and had barely had time to see the July issue of the Mahabodhi through the press, or listen to Saratha's accounts of how he and Sangharatana had fared in Ceylon with Anagarika Sugatananda. They had not fared very well, the little monk admitted ruefully, pursing his lips and shaking his head at the recollection of what he and his brother monk had had to endure. The Anagarika undoubtedly possessed a good knowledge of the Dhamma and was an excellent speaker, and the speeches he had delivered at 20 or more different parts of the island, speeches which he and Sangharatana had translated, had been received with great enthusiasm. But he possessed a foul temper, was extremely exigent, and quarrelled with almost everyone with whom he had any dealings. 100 times a day he and Sangharatana had exclaimed to each other, If only we were travelling with Sangharakshita and translating for him instead of for Sugatananda. As it happened, this could well have been the case. Only a few months earlier, the Mahabodhi Society in Ceylon had proposed that I should write a full-length biography of Anagarika Dhammapala and invited me to spend a few months at their Colombo headquarters for that purpose. Had I accepted the proposal, and so far I had not actually rejected it, I could have been leaving for Ceylon that afternoon instead of for Bangalore, and Saratha, instead of coming to the station to see me off, could have been accompanying me. With me in the second-class sleeping compartment, in which I had a reserved berth, were three other passengers, all of them South Indians. Two were middle-aged businessmen, the third a Catholic priest. It was my experience that even travellers not occupying the more democratic third-class and inter-class carriages usually were not slow to enter into conversation, especially if their journey was going to be a long one. But on this occasion, my friendly overtures met with little success. Neither of the two businessmen knew much Hindi. I knew only a few words of Tamil, while the priest was obviously wary of speaking to an Englishman who very evidently was not a Christian and might, for all he knew, actually be the devil in disguise. I therefore took out André Gide's The Immoralist, which I had bought a few days previously, and was soon absorbed in Michel's adventure, as the author called his hero's story of his self-discovery, of the growth in him of a confused consciousness of untouched treasures, somewhere lying covered up, hidden, quote, smothered by culture and decency and morality, unquote. Of the terrible cost of freedom, and of the burden that freedom itself could be. So absorbed was I in the story that I did not sleep that night until, long after the occupants of the other berths had switched off their lights, I had turned the last page of the book. Whether because of my having spent the previous evening absorbed in The Immoralist, or on account of a difference in the air, we were not far from the coast, or simply because I had slept particularly well, when I awoke in the morning, my mood was one of exhilaration. It was a mood that was enhanced by my enjoyment of the lyricism of certain passages in Gide's Fruits of the Earth, which I had bought at the same time as The Immoralist, and into which, after an early breakfast, I started dipping. But though I enjoyed the French writer's lyricism, as a whole his prose style was too stilted and self-conscious, I had almost said too affected, for my taste, nor did I like his constant references to the deity, or appreciate the curious mixture, in later Fruits of the Earth, of the Gospels and communism. For all his avowed hedonism and his protestations that he called nature God, he struck me as being in some ways a very Christian, even a very Protestant sort of writer. And after a while I laid the book aside and spent the rest of the morning looking out of the window. At every station at which the train stopped, and there were many stops, it was wonderful to see what a variety of things was being sold by the hawkers who marched up and down the platform crying their wares. There were cakes, biscuits, fruits, books and magazines in half a dozen languages and half a dozen scripts, brightly painted toys and fried delicacies hot and crisp from the pan, as well as lunches which came packeted in a plantain leaf and with each individual item, even the green ones, neatly wrapped in its own separate segment of rubbery green. One such lunch I bought. It cost me only a rupee and two annas, and was the best meal I had tasted in a long time. What a difference there was, I reflected, between the stations on the Calcutta-Madras line and those on the Calcutta-Siliguri one, on which there were relatively few stations, and where it was sometimes impossible to get so much as a cup of tea. Nor was it only the stations and the catering arrangements that were different. The landscape, too, had changed, especially now that we had entered Madras State. Gone was the dense green vegetation, so rank and so profuse, of Bengal and Orissa, vegetation out of which there protruded every few miles the cluster of thatched huts that denoted a village. In its stead was a predominance of scrub and bare soil, with, here and there, a line of Arica palms silhouetted against the sky. We were in another climatic region, another culture, even another world, one that differed from the world of northern India in so many ways, and which I had not seen for more than 5 years. Already Calcutta, and even the foothills of the Himalayas where I now lived and worked, seemed very far away. And as the warm afternoon wore on, I found myself reviewing my activities over the last 2 months, from my return to Kalimpong after editing the Vaishakha number of the Mahabodhi, to my arrival in Calcutta the previous week, almost as though they had been those of another person. May and June had been comparatively uneventful. I had continued to teach Sachin, Meera, and Lobsang Phantsok, and to spend time with visitors. The Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society had celebrated Vaishakha Purnima, both with a religious function at the Hermitage and a public meeting at the town hall. Dinesh had left in a huff after being told he must either mend his ways or find somewhere else to stay. And Sachin and I had spent the week in Darjeeling and Kursiong, in each of which places I lectured and conferred with local Buddhists, besides spending a night at Longview, where I renewed acquaintance with Dutt Manjumdar, the deputy commissioner, who, with the district superintendent of police, was then investigating a disturbance in a neighbouring tea estate. But uneventful though May and June had been, there was one circumstance that was perhaps of greater significance in the light of subsequent developments than I realised at the time. This was the fact that, prominent among the 4 or 5 local Buddhists whom I invited to address the Vaishakha meeting at the town hall, was the red-robed figure of Dado Rinpoche, the Gelug incarnate Lama, who lived in the old Bhutan Palace at 11th Mile. We had met the previous year when I went to see him in connection with a dispute that had arisen in Bodh Gaya between him as abbot of the Tibetan monastery there and the monk in charge of the adjacent Mahabodhi rest house, and I had come away from the interview not only convinced that he was the innocent party, but deeply impressed by his patent goodwill, candour, and integrity. It was no surprise to me, therefore, that when I took Pani to see him a few days before the town hall meeting, my spiritually minded Bengali friend should have been equally impressed, and have commented in the warmest terms on the Rinpoche's serene, friendly, and unassuming behaviour. As this was Pani's first experience of Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhists, I was delighted that his impression was such a positive one. His impression of Christianity, at least in its missionary form, was rather less positive. As we passed through Dr. Graham's homes one morning, on our way to a picnic at Dailo, I was mocked and jeered at over the wall of their cottage by a group of teenage Christian boys, who evidently regarded a Buddhist monk as an interloper and an enemy. Usually I ignored such manifestations of intolerance, but on the present occasion I swept in through the gate, closely followed by Pani, the boys scattering in terror as I did so, with cries of, "He's coming in!" Inside the cottage I found the house mother, as she was called, and severely upbraided her for not teaching her charges to show more respect for the representatives of other religions. The wretched woman stammered a half-apology, though she was not personally to blame for what was still in fact the ethos of the whole institution, despite independence. And later on I sent Mr. Duncan, the superintendent of the homes, a formal letter of complaint. Recalling the incident that warm afternoon as I reviewed my activities over the last 2 months, I wondered, not for the first time, what it was that made people intolerant of beliefs and practices other than their own, and whether some religions were not intolerant by their very nature. Christianity appeared to fall within this category. All its major historical forms had on occasion proscribed and persecuted, even tortured and burned alive at the stake. It was not surprising that the missionaries, inheritors as they were of this grim tradition, and surrounded as they believed themselves to be by the forces of darkness, should be narrow-minded and intolerant. Christianity was said to have taken firm root in South India. Were the missionaries of Madras, I wondered, as intolerant as those of Kalimpong? Madras. After I had spent a second night in the train, here we were at Madras Central, and here was Venerable Jinananda waiting on the platform to welcome me and whisk me off to the Mahabodhi Centre in Kennett Lane for breakfast. Though quite large, the building in which I partook of that meal was old and inconvenient, and I noticed that there was no shrine room. Like several other Mahabodhi centres, the place was not so much, in fact, a temple or a monastery, as a caravanserai for Sinhalese pilgrims on their way to the holy places of northern India. The bhikkhu in charge looked after the pilgrims, made merit for them by accepting their offerings. Making merit was the principal object of a pilgrimage for old-fashioned Buddhists. And in his spare time, he did what he could to propagate the Dharma among the more educated portion of the predominantly Hindu population. On the whole, it was not a very inspiring life for a well-meaning monk, as Jinananda seemed to be. And in the afternoon, after I had written a few letters, he was glad to accompany me to the Ramakrishna Math at Mylapore, the Brahmin quarter of the city. Here I met Swami Kailashananda, the Math's rather saturnine president. I had met him in the same place 7 years earlier, within days of my going forth from home into the homeless life, and when I was still rather conscious of my shaven head and saffron robes. On that occasion he had seemed dubious of the wisdom of the step I had just taken, but now, no doubt realizing that I had persevered in my chosen way of life, he welcomed me as cordially as his rather aloof temperament permitted, and we had a very friendly conversation. Back in Kennett Lane, having found the city's leading bookshop closed, I talked to a young monk who was studying at one of the local colleges, and then left to catch the overnight train to Bangalore, Jinananda accompanying me to the station and seeing me off. Bangalore was one of the pleasantest cities in India. From the fact that its central area abounded in beautifully laid out parks and gardens, some of which dated from the Mughal period, it was known as the Garden City. In 1949 I had spent several weeks there on my way back to northern India and, I hoped, formal monastic ordination, and I thought I knew the city. But as the car that had met me at the station made its way through the busy streets to the Wadia's residence, on a tree-lined avenue in a quiet suburb, I failed to recognise a single landmark. Either Bangalore had changed a lot, as had so many Indian cities in the years following independence, or I had seen less of it than I supposed. The residence in question was a substantial Western-style building. As if to emphasise the owner's link with Buddhism, it was called Maitri Bhavan, which could be rendered as the abode of loving-kindness. Maitri, or loving-kindness, being the first of the four Brahma-viharas, or sublime mental states, to be developed in meditation by the Buddhist. P.P. Wadia was there to welcome me. We had not met before, but on one of my visits to Bombay, I had been taken to Flora Fountain to hear him speak on theosophy, and had a vivid memory of a packed hall and a powerful lecture that obviously impressed the audience deeply. In appearance he had not changed much since then. As his surname indicated, he was by birth a Parsi, in fact a member of the wealthy Bombay shipping family. but he was taller and bulkier than the average member of his community, and wore, moreover, a beard, which, together with his benign look and confident bearing, served to give him an appearance of almost regal dignity. After we had talked for a while, he escorted me to the Institute, and there installed me in the guest room. For the rest of the morning, I was left to my own devices, so that I was able to look at the extensive and well-equipped library, next to which the guest room was conveniently situated, and write a few letters. It was then time for lunch. This I had at Maitri Bhavan with B.P. Wadia, after which the car returned me to the Institute, where I rested and wrote more letters, and where I received a visit from Dr. and Mrs. Dorai Swami, who it seemed were responsible for the day-to-day running of things. The former, as I already knew, and as he was not slow to remind me, was a cousin of my friend R.A. Padmanathan, the hospital manager of Longview. That evening I met Sophia Wadia, with whom I'd been so long in correspondence. Younger than her husband, who must have been well over 60, and the shorter by a head, she had a broad forehead, an earnest expression, and a resonant contralto voice that at times seemed too big for her frame, and she was dressed entirely in white, almost like a priestess. Annie Besant, as I remembered reading somewhere, had also dressed entirely in white, even her shoes being of that colour, so that it was possible for a Brahmin admirer to style her, on account of her erudition and eloquence, as Sarva Shukla Saraswati, or the All-White Saraswati. Saraswati being the popular Hindu goddess of education and learning. There was no doubt that Sophia Wadia could also be so styled, at least as far as her appearance went. Whether she was comparable to the legendary Annie Besant, in point of erudition and eloquence, was another matter. Soon I had an opportunity of judging for myself, or at least of forming an initial impression. Maitri Bhavan, where we met, besides being the residence of the Wadias when they were in Bangalore, was the local centre, apparently, of the United Lodge of Theosophists, the branch of the theosophical movement to which the couple belonged, and it so happened that there was to be a study class that evening. I was invited to sit in on this class, which was led by Sophia Wadia, and was on a section of Robert Crosby's book, The Friendly Philosopher. The name of Robert Crosby was new to me. As I discovered later, he was an American theosophist, under whose guidance and inspiration the United Lodge of Theosophists had been formed in 1909 in Los Angeles, California. He had worked closely with W.Q. Judge, joint founder with Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott of the Theosophical Society, in 1975. And in the ULT, his and Judge's writings were prized next only to the more voluminous but less immediately accessible output of Madame Blavatsky. Though I found his book, The Friendly Philosopher, or rather the section of it which was chosen for study that evening, rather pedestrian, from her comments on the text, as well as from her replies to questions, it was obvious that Sophia Wadia had a thorough knowledge of the principles of theosophy and could explain them clearly. I noticed, however, that the dozen or so members of the class stood very much in awe of her, as they did of her husband, and that, on account presumably of her French extraction, she was addressed deferentially as Madame. As my lectures were not due to begin for 3 or 4 days, I was able to take advantage of the library and to read works to which I did not have access in Kalimpong or even in Calcutta. The Institute's library was in fact the best I had encountered since my time at Benares Hindu University with Kashyapji, when my kind teacher had allowed me to use his ticket to the university library, and contained many rare and valuable items collected by B.P. Wadia in the course of his travels in the West. Besides immersing myself in such authorities on Buddhism as Suzuki and E.J. Thomas,
I dipped quite extensively into Oscar Wilde, W.B. Yeats and A.E., in other words, George William Russell. A discovery of particular interest was Literature and Occult Tradition by Denis Seurat, an author of whom I had not heard before. There were also letters to write, and members of the Institute to see, among the latter being S.K. Ramachandra Rao, with whom I had corresponded a couple of years previously, and who was deeply interested in Buddhism. The two people of whom I saw most were naturally B.P. and Sophia Wadia, with whom I had lunch every day at Maitri Bhavan, and more often than not, a lengthy conversation. Most of our discussion centred on Buddhism, especially in its relation to the teachings of Madame Blavatsky. And although I sometimes disagreed with my host and hostess, I could not but admire the purity of their devotion to theosophy and the sincerity with which they strove to apply its principles to their own lives. Lunch may have been served in some style, with a butler and other servants in attendance, but it was simple to the point of being Spartan, and the meal was always preceded by a reading from a religious text and a few minutes of silent recollection. On one occasion we discussed the missionary threat and Roman Catholic dogmatism, about which both husband and wife felt very much as I did. And Sophia Wadia explained how, when she was at a lecture tour in Argentina, she seemed to have South American connections, she had been given police protection, as the authorities had received information that the Jesuits might try to poison her. In the evening, there was usually a function of some kind to attend, either at Maitri Bhavan or at the Institute. Thus, I heard my white-robed hostess give an address on, quote, after death, what, unquote, at the former venue, while at the latter, a speaker having failed to turn up, two members of the Bangalore intelligentsia, M.K. Venkata Rao and K. Guru Dutt, gave brilliant extemporaneous talks on the philosophy of George Santayana. As the talented duo were not unrepresentative of the kind of audience I would shortly be addressing, I was thankful that I had prepared my lectures with even more than my usual care. In a way, I had been preparing the lectures for some months, at least in my own mind. It might even be said that I had been preparing them for some years, in fact, ever since I awoke to the fact that I was a Buddhist, and that between them they constituted a summation of all I had learned about Buddhism during the intervening period, whether from books, from my teachers, from discussions with friends and foes, that is, foes of the Dharma, and from my own independent reflection and meditative experience. B.P. Wadia's invitation indeed came at exactly the right moment for me, as well as at the right moment for the movement of Buddhist revival in modern India, then on the eve of experiencing a dramatic quantum leap, and presented me with both an opportunity and a challenge. With an opportunity, inasmuch as I would be communicating the Dharma to a predominantly Hindu audience, which, intelligent though it might be, possessed for the most part only a superficial or distorted understanding of the Buddha's teaching. With a challenge, inasmuch as I would be able to take full advantage of that opportunity only if I stood back and asked myself how I really saw Buddhism and what it really meant to me. Work on the preparation of the lectures in the more specific sense had started only a month earlier, when B.P. Wadia wrote asking me to draw up a prospectus for distribution as part of the Institute's publicity. This entailed finding a title for each lecture and therewith determining what material it should contain, as well as finding a title for the whole series, which eventually I decided to call A Survey of Buddhism, Its Doctrines and Methods Through the Ages. With acknowledgements as to the subtitle to the excellent volume of Buddhist texts that had just appeared under the editorship of Dr. Konza. For a lecture, as distinct from a sermon of the traditional type which I delivered extemporaneously, I was in the habit of making a few notes, covering at most only a page or two. On this occasion, however, I made several pages of notes for each lecture, for my view, like that of observation in the opening lines of Dr. Johnson's famous poem, was going to be an extensive one,
and I will be surveying, not, indeed, mankind from China to Peru, but Buddhism from the Theravada to Zen and Shin. Moreover, I will be surveying it not only in its breadth, but in its depth, which meant seeing it in its deeper interconnections, both within itself and in relation to the Dharma life of the individual Buddhist. This called for a tremendous intellectual and spiritual effort on my part, an effort that the putting together of the notes, concentrative of my energies as this was, helped me to make. The notes for most of the lectures had already been written. In fact, I had only the notes for the fourth lecture to write, those for the first three having been assembled during my week or so in Calcutta, which is why I could spend my first few days in Bangalore taking advantage of the library, seeing people, and attending functions at Maitri Bhavan and the Institute. I started giving the series on Tuesday, the 6th of July, 4 days after my arrival, when I spoke of the Buddha and Buddhism. I spoke to a full hall, and under the chairmanship of Sophia Wadia, who, after saying a few words of gracious introduction, read my poem, Taking Refuge in the Buddha. The audience being quite new to me, I fumbled for the first few minutes, getting the feel of it, so to speak. But once I had done this, and for me, getting the feel of an audience was a process so tangible as to be almost physical, I very quickly got into my stride, and with the help of my notes, spoke fluently for more than an hour and a half. In speaking about the Buddha, I was concerned not so much to recount the story of his life, complete with legendary embellishments, as to place that life within its traditional cosmological context, and by so doing, to reveal in what the Buddha's greatness and role truly consisted. Similarly, in speaking of Buddhism in the sense of the original doctrine, I did not want to dwell on specific ethical and spiritual teachings, important as those teachings undoubtedly were, so much as to lay bare the philosophical principle underlying them, the principle, that is to say, of universal conditionality in its two modes, the cyclical and the spiral. In particular, I wanted to show that the Buddhist nirvana was not synonymous with a state of annihilation, as the Hindu critics of Buddhism believed, any more than the path leading to that nirvana consisted solely in the eradication of negative mental states. My second lecture, which followed 2 days later, was devoted to Hinayana and Mahayana. In it, I insisted on the transcendental unity of all forms of Buddhism, traced the rise of the Mahayana, and dealt with some of the more important of its distinctive tenets. I was also at pains to emphasize the purely instrumental nature of the Dharma. In between the giving of these two lectures, I continued to see people and to attend functions at Maitri Bhavan and the Institute, besides going for a drive with the Dorai Swami's son, who showed me the famous Lal Bagh with its centuries-old trees, and took me into the city centre. Mrs. Doraiswamy, his mother, for her part, showed me round the cosmopolitan home, the student hostel the Wadias had built next door to the Institute, and where there was a devotional meeting once a week led by B.P. Wadia. She was an Englishwoman by birth, and I was glad to find that she shared my own views regarding Christian missionaries. The Institute and the Bangalore ULT, that is, United Lodge of Theosophists, had in fact several English and Dutch members, some of whom were married to Indians. As in Singapore, where I first encountered Theosophists in 1946, it was heartening to see people of different races and different national and religious backgrounds. The Institute even had a few Christian and Muslim members associating on terms of friendship. Though I might not agree with some of the teachings of Theosophy, I was certainly full of admiration for the way in which individual Theosophists, both Adyar and non-Adyar, sought to practice the principle of universal brotherhood, the first of the three declared objects of the parent Theosophical Society. The next two lectures, which I gave on the 12th and the 14th of July, were firmly based on the two previous ones. Having dealt with some of the more important of the Mahayana's distinctive tenets in my second lecture, I proceeded in my third on the schools of the Mahayana to deal in turn with the scriptures, teachers and treatises of the Madhyamakavada, of devotional Buddhism, of the Yogacara, and of Tantric Buddhism. Each school, I declared, had developed a specific aspect of Buddhism, and far from their being mutually exclusive, the Mahayana itself could be understood only if they were viewed in their totality as complementary aspects of the Dharma. The fourth and last lecture in the series was dedicated to the Bodhisattva ideal. After describing the place of the Bodhisattva ideal in Buddhist thought and dealing with popular interpretations, I outlined the Bodhisattva doctrine as presented in authoritative texts. I then gave an account afterwards described as glowing, of the six paramitas or perfections and the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva's career, and concluded by trying to communicate to my audience something of my own enthusiasm for the spiritual life as exemplified by the glorious Bodhisattva ideal. Despite having notes to make, in between my third and fourth lectures, I found time for two encounters of an ecumenical nature. The first of these was with the Jain community. At their invitation, I visited their temple, where they gave me a formal reception, complete with tea party and speeches of welcome, and where I spoke of my contacts with Jainism and on the Jain doctrine of Anekantavada. My second such encounter, which was of a more intimate character, was with the bright-eyed, gnome-like Roman Catholic priest named Father Monchanin, one of the founders of the first Christian ashram, with whom I had a two-hour-long conversation on Buddhism, especially the Madhyamikavada, the Vedanta, and comparative mysticism. After the conclusion of the fourth lecture, and therewith the completion of my survey, the Wadiyas and I left for Maitri Bhavan, where 14 or 15 leading members and friends of the Institute later joined us for an informal celebration. Both BP and Sophia Wadia were highly pleased with the lectures, the former having asked me, after I'd given my first lecture, to write them out for publication in book form. Indeed, from what I heard that evening, I gathered the series had attracted a good deal of attention, and even been something of an event in the cultural and religious life of Bangalore. This did not surprise me. Throughout the series, the hall, comfortably full at first, had become more tightly packed with each lecture, while the audience, greatly augmented though it was, had grown ever more attentive and more concentrated. Thus, by the time I gave the last lecture, I had a very large and appreciative audience indeed, such as the Institute apparently had not seen before. It was an audience, moreover, with which I had succeeded in establishing a definite rapport. As I spoke, and they listened, time almost stood still. It was as though we were transported to another world. To what extent they felt this, I could not tell, but I certainly felt it very strongly, and whether on account of their receptivity or on account of my own enthusiasm for the Dharma, or both, at the end of one lecture in particular, I found myself in a very exalted state of consciousness. That time should almost stand still was not without its disadvantages, even though the audience and I might be transported to another world. The Wadiyas, contrary to the usual Indian practice, were great sticklers for punctuality and keeping to schedule, and before the commencement of the series, I was warned that I should on no account exceed my allotted 60, or at the very most 75 minutes, as this could seriously disrupt whatever other events might have been planned for the rest of the evening. Unfortunately, my first lecture exceeded even the more generous allotment by a full 15 minutes, and subsequent lectures exceeded it by as much as half an hour or more. The fact was that I had so much material, and found that material so inspiring, that it was hardly possible for me to keep to the prescribed limit, without doing a serious injustice to my subject, and perhaps even to myself. Moreover, though Sophia Wadia kept glancing meaningfully at the clock when my time was up, as did her successors in the chair, it was clear the audience did not want me to stop, and both then and subsequently, I ignored the signals and carried on. Each time this little drama between the speaker and the chair was enacted, smiles of amusement appeared on people's faces. Evidently, they were by no means averse to seeing protocol flung to the winds and the proceedings conducted in a manner that was more in accordance with Indian cultural traditions. As for my host and hostess, in the goodness of their hearts, they refrained from taking me to task for my intransigence, though it was obvious that they ran the Institute and the ULT as very tight ships and were not accustomed to having their wishes disregarded. Having made the notes for three of my lectures in Calcutta, I did not have much to do by way of preparation in Bangalore. Nonetheless, during the week in which I was engaged in surveying Buddhism, I had thought it best to avoid distractions as much as I could and stay close to base, my base being the double one of the Institute and Maitri Bhavan. Now, however, the lectures were over and I was able to see more people and go out and about more. As the second city of a predominantly Kannada-speaking area that had once been under Muslim rule, Bangalore was a tolerant, cosmopolitan place with a polyglot citizenry and included people from most parts of India and of many different faiths. Among those who came to see me, or whose hospitality I accepted, there were Bengalis and Kashmiris, Tamilians and Mysoreans, devotees of Swami Ram Das and disciples of Ramana Maharshi, followers of the Lingayat sect, Vishishtavadavaita Pandits, Muslims, Christians and Jains, but not a single Buddhist, though after my first lecture, a local man had come up to me and introduced himself and his wife as Buddhists. Most of those who came did so out of curiosity or to talk religion in the platitudinous, pseudo-intellectual sort of way that was so common in India. I once observed that Hindus, in particular, discussed religion much as the English discussed the weather. Or even to beg me, as one elderly Tamil Brahmin repeatedly did, to teach them some tantric rites. A few there were, however, whose interest was of a more serious nature. They included two young men, one of them a student, with whom I had several worthwhile discussions, and to whom, at their earnest request, I explained the Anapanasati, or respiration mindfulness practice. Not that I usually taught meditation, or even thought of myself as a meditation teacher. Though I now had been meditating for a number of years, my principal concern was still to deepen my own practice, and while I had no objection to explaining Anapanasati to the occasional sincere individual, it was to be many years before I started teaching meditation on a regular basis, or to more than one person at a time. The fact that I saw more people and went out and about more during my last few days in the Garden City did not mean that I neglected my base. If anything, I had more to do with it than ever. To begin with, the lectures, having created intense interest among the local intelligentsia, many of whom declared that it was the first time they had been given a complete and coherent picture of Buddhism, B.P. Wadia made arrangements for a special question-and-answer meeting. At this meeting, which was held under the chairmanship of his white-robed co-adjutrix, I answered more than 60 written questions on the philosophy, history, literature, and spiritual practices of Buddhism. B.P. Wadia also arranged for me to give, under his own chairmanship, a lecture on The Voice of the Silence, the devotional treatise compiled and translated by Madame Blavatsky, allegedly from Tibetan Buddhist sources. I was quite fond of this little work, which I knew to be immensely popular with all theosophists, though in view of some of its terminology, I found it difficult to regard it as being in toto an authentically Buddhist composition. Besides making these two additional appearances at the Institute, I gave several informal talks for the benefit of the occupants of the cosmopolitan home, B.P. Wadia apparently thinking that the students, to whom he stood in loco parentis, could not have too much of a good thing in the way of moral and religious instruction from visiting holy men of whatever persuasion. On other occasions, I carried my base, as represented by the Wadias, with me when I went out, or my base carried me. Thus, my host and hostess and I were guests at a lunch given by the Gataks, and spent a musical evening with the Laukakas. Among the other guests at the lunch were Svetoslav Rerich, the younger brother of George Rerich, and his wife Devika Rani, the famous film actress, both of whom I had met a few weeks earlier in Kalimpong at a tea party given by Mrs. Tagore in honour of Dr. and Mrs. Liebenthal's 40th wedding anniversary. I was seated opposite Devika Rani, and we talked about her mother, a niece, or perhaps it was a grandniece of Tagore, whom I had known in Kasali, and who in fact was one of the last people to whom I spoke before going forth from home into the homeless life in August 1947. At the Laukakas, the Wadias and I were the only guests. Major Laukata had served in the British, not the Indian, army, and though no longer wearing the Queen's uniform, was very pro-British. He was also very pro-Western. So extremely pro-Western was he, that he and his wife had not been content to adopt the language and social customs of their former rulers. They had gone so far as to adopt their religion too. Both were converts to Roman Catholic Christianity. I noticed that running round the pointed arch of every doorframe in their comfortable European-style bungalow, there was a text from the Vulgate, neatly executed in Gothic script and in the original Latin. Despite such apparent signs of orthodoxy, the kind and hospitable Laukatas were not in the least bigoted, as converts to Roman Catholicism so often were, and I concluded that their Christianity was a matter of culture rather than of religion in the strict sense. Major Laukaka was in fact a great lover of Western classical music, and in the course of the evening he played some of his favourite Bach and Mozart records for us on the gramophone. In my teens, I had been passionately fond of classical music, and had listened to it on the radio as much as I could. During my years in India, I had been able to hear it only in odd snatches and by accident, and in any case, there was a rule prohibiting members of the Theravadin monastic order from listening to music. As the ultra-orthodox Narada Thera had once remarked to Lama Govinda in my hearing, a Buddhist monk was not allowed to appreciate beauty, and classical music was certainly beautiful. Yet though I had been so fond of classical music in the past, and had listened to it so much, I did not miss it now, and never felt that I was being deprived of something essential to my emotional well-being. I could therefore enjoy Major Laukaka's Bach and Mozart without wanting to prolong or repeat the experience. And even when, on my departure, he presented me with two boxes of records, my only thought, apart from gratitude to him for his generosity, was that since I did not possess a gramophone, I would have to give them to somebody who did. Perhaps Joe would like them. Less harmonious than the musical evening at the Laukakas, in principle at least, was the situation I encountered when Sophia Wadi and I, on the afternoon of my last day in Bangalore, went to see the Vihara that was being built at Gandhinagar in the older western quarter of the city. It was being built by the Mahabodhi Society of Ceylon and was nearing completion, and we were being shown round the place by A.R.S. Chari, the retired judge of the Bangalore High Court, who had presided at my lecture on Hinayana and Mahayana. Mr. Chari, I gathered, was in overall charge of the building project. He was also chairman of the Vihara Committee. Or rather, he was chairman of one of the two committees then contending in the courts for control of the Vihara. The dispute had been going on for some time, as a paper drawn up by the retired judge informed me, and had become quite complicated. Whether by accident or by design, the leading member of the other committee, one Ramaswamy, was on the premises at the very time Sophia Wadi and I were being shown round, and later that day he came to see me at the institute. It did not take me long to get to the root of the problem. The root of the problem, as so often was the case in South India, was the deep-seated antagonism between Brahmins and non-Brahmins. Chari was a Brahmin, Ramaswamy a non-Brahmin. Chari's committee consisted of Brahmins and other caste Hindus, Ramaswamis, of members of the scheduled castes. Several of these latter were, it seemed, followers of Dr. Ambedkar, who for years had been telling the scheduled castes peoples that there would be no improvement in their lot so long as they remained within the Hindu fold, and that they would have to change their religion. Only recently had there been rumours to the effect that the scheduled castes leader was about to embrace Buddhism together with his followers, and several of the questions handed in at my question and answer meeting related to this burning topic. From the nature of the questions, it was fairly obvious that the caste Hindus were opposed to any change of religion on the part of the scheduled castes peoples, and I was left with the impression that should Ambedkar and his followers ever take the drastic step of giving up Hinduism for Buddhism, they could expect little sympathy or understanding from that quarter. Much as caste Hindus might appreciate Buddhism, to them it was only a branch of Hinduism. They saw no need for anyone born a Hindu to convert to it, as though it was a separate religion like Christianity or Islam. In their eyes, Ambedkar was simply a politician, and his periodic threats of mass defections from Hinduism were no more than a political stunt. Scheduled castes, South Indians like Ramaswamy, saw things differently. For them, Ambedkar's threats were seriously meant, and conversion to Buddhism was a real option. Caste Hindu insistence that Buddhism was not a separate religion, but only a branch of Hinduism, was intended, so they believed, to make it impossible for the scheduled castes people to escape from Hinduism, and therefore from caste Hindu tyranny and exploitation. Chari's involvement in the affairs of the Bangalore branch of the Mahabodhi Society had a similar purpose. He and his Brahmin and other caste Hindu friends knew that a revival of Buddhism was inevitable, and they wanted to be in a position to contain it. According to no less an authority than Swami Vivekananda, Hinduism had killed Buddhism with a loving embrace, and it was no doubt try to repeat this performance if its hated rival ever came back to life. Thus, the root of the conflict between the two Vihara committees was not even just a conflict between Brahmins and non-Brahmins, or between caste Hindus and members of the scheduled castes. It was a conflict also between different attitudes towards Buddhism, even different ideologies. If those conflicts were not resolved, or even if they were, what would be the future of the Vihara? What would be the future of Buddhism in Bangalore?
End of chapter 9.